This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take another look at the case of Lynn Stewart and her request for compassionate release.
We talk with her attorney, Jill Shallow Levine. The government so far has shown no mercy with respect to Lynn, but momentum to get her out is building. Evidence of that momentum is Attorney General Eric Holder's new guidelines on compassionate release.
One Nation Under Surveillance. That's the name of a campaign by the D.C.-based group, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund.
We'll talk today with Attorney Carl Massinio, one of the principals of the partnership, on what they're doing to expose government surveillance.
This year marks the 52nd anniversary of the start of the Agent Orange chemical warfare program in Vietnam.
The American Air Force dropped millions of pounds of dioxin, a cancer-causing chemical, on the Vietnamese and also it infected American GIs. We talk about what can be done to help these people who are so sick.
Stay with us.
Author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, last week we had a momentous victory in the lawsuit Floyd v. City of New York brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights against the police department's policy of stop and frisks.
It took years and it took months to try it. But we got lucky. Judge Shindland is probably the best judge on the bench. There was a profile done of her in the Law Journal 6 months ago where she said, look, I'm appointed for life and I can do the right thing. And she practically accused her other judges of being cowards in not standing for doing the right thing. She did the right thing in the Floyd case. She said that the police department of the city of New York violated both the Fourth Amendment and the 14th Amendment. And we'll go into that in a second. And she said, you're racially profiling. You're stopping over 600,000, mostly black and Latino young people every year. And then she said, and you're terrorizing them and you're terrorizing their parents.
She also noted, Michael, that the flaw in the government's argument that these were so-called high-crime neighborhoods and individuals who commit crimes lacked a merit because only 1 or 2% of those stopped were then arrested. It pointed out, really, the illegality of the practice and tore a hole in their argument.
Yeah, exactly. It was obvious that these people were being profiled, which is a violation of the 14th Amendment, and their privacy was being invaded. They have a right to expect to be laid off by these cops instead of when they walk out of their home to be busted, which happens regularly. Remember, we had a bunch of these young people on the show 2 years ago and talked to them about how this happened to them all the time. That violates the Fourth Amendment.
Right. As they get out of school, as they walk home from school, they're used to it. It's a part of daily life. What I thought was interesting was the city's response. Michael Bloomberg saying, almost like a crybaby, we didn't get a fair trial.
When he said, we didn't get a fair trial, who's he talking about? He said the cops didn't get a fair trial. Well, that's not the city of New York. The city of New York were the plaintiffs in this case, not the police department. We did get a fair trial.
I also thought it was interesting that Michael Bloomberg, who's installed hundreds of surveillance cameras all around the city of New York, is objecting to the judge's decision order that certain officers in certain precincts wear small cameras to record these street encounters.
Yeah, that was rich. Now, the judge did not stay her remedial rulings. They go into effect. That's going to be a fight. The city's
meaning
going to
appeal. The monitoring,
the camera.
Right.
I think that's going to be an ongoing fight with the cops.
But it's worth pointing out, Michael, that many, many other jurisdictions around the country have similar programs in place, either consent decrees. Now, a consent decree is an agreement reached by both parties, so they agree to install monitoring. New York, of course, did not agree. But the point is, this is not an unusual occurrence.
No, not at all. It's just that we have this, you have to say, racist mayor and Kelly, the police commissioner, who are digging in their heels, just like they did in the Vulcan case.
Exactly, where, the firefighters case.
Yeah, where it was demonstrated that for many, many years, they racially discriminated in who they let into the fire department. And when we won that one, they appealed it. And they're going to appeal this one, too. So the fight's not over, but we won the first round.
An important victory for New Yorkers.
Heidi Boghossian, you've recently written Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance. It's a terrific book, and our listeners are interested, I'm sure, in what kind of response the book is getting, and what kind of speaking engagements have you been asked to do, and comments on radio and TV about the book. How's it going? What kind of publicity are you getting from Spying on Democracy?
Well, thanks to Mr. Snowden, I've been getting several requests to do radio shows around the country, and it's been a wonderful opportunity to talk to some great stations, including a few affiliates that carry Law and Disorder. But it's been a really fun experience, and the subject matter is clearly in the forefront of everyone's minds right now. So I'm lucky to have this opportunity.
You getting book reviews from it?
I've gotten one book review, another one's coming out in a couple of weeks. Luckily, they've been favorable so far. One was from actually a group that I mentioned in the book, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and I was very proud of that because I respect their work so much.
Yeah, you know, I read that book review. Let me give our audience just a couple sentences from it because they really liked it, and that's a mark of distinction to have that group come forward. They say, Heidi Boghossian, Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance is a colorful, illustrative primer on governmental and private sector intelligence gathering. And then they went on to talk about each of the book's 13 chapters, specifically about private corporations and how they're involved, a real boost for the book's notice.
Well, I wanted to mention just a bit about EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. They've been around since 1994, and their focus is emerging civil liberties issues and the protection of privacy, the First Amendment, and the Constitution, vis-a-vis, obviously, electronics. But what I thought was interesting was a year ago they filed a Freedom of Information Act request and then a subsequent lawsuit to force disclosure of FBI documents about the technical specifications of something called Stingray.
Stingray. Corvette.
Well, yeah, me too. But this can triangulate the source of a cellular signal. And how it does that is, in effect, it acts as a fake cell phone tower. So it measures signal strengths of particular electronic device from several locations. And with Stingrays, government agents can locate, interfere with, and intercept communications from cell phones and wireless devices. Apparently, the FBI has used this simulator technology of a similar kind since at least 1995. The lawsuit filed in 2012 is called U.S. v. Rig Maiden, which involves use of the Stingray. The government actually admitted in the lawsuit that its actions were intrusive enough to rise to a Fourth Amendment violation.
That's unbelievable. So you're telling me that the cell phone is really not a cell phone. It's a locator device
exactly.
of the government. That's
right.
Also a cell phone.
Yeah. It's very get smart.
You know, I thought something else that the EPIC review said was really on the money. Boghossian also turns her unflinching analysis to corporate culture and the ways in which private companies contribute to a surveillance society. That's what's scary. Here we've got this government-private corporation cooperation to spy on us. And I think your book, Spying on Democracy, more than anything I know, lays that all out.
Thank you, Michael.
When Michael Ratner comes back from vacation, I want to have a discussion amongst the three of us about the details of the book.
Thank you.
Last week, New York City Federal District Judge Kotel stated he couldn't consider Lynn Stewart's request for compassionate release because by law it needs to come from the Bureau of Prisons. Judge Codall also pointed out that the Bureau of Prison didn't properly consider Lynn's medical evidence by saying her condition was improving. Meanwhile, Lynn's doctors have given her a prognosis of 24 to 18 months to live. We're joined today by Lynn Stewart's attorney, Jill Shallow Levine, who recently argued the Bureau of Prisons violated the intention of the law itself. She gives us an update on the case. Jill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we first wanted to ask you about Eric Holder's remarks before the American Bar Association announcing, in effect, some changes to procedures on compassionate release. Is that going to have an effect on Lynn's case?
It certainly makes it easier for the Bureau of Prisons to grant Lynn's request. In April of this year, largely, I think, in response to the report, to a report issued by the Department of Justice Inspector General's office that was harshly critical of the way the Bureau has administered the program, the Bureau made some changes. Among other things, it allowed us how inmates who are whose prognosis is terminal within 18 months are now eligible, whereas before, under the old rules, it had been 12 months. Things like that. Lynn's application, in fact, was considered under those rules that went into effect in April. What Holder's speech did is to create a new atmosphere, or hopefully contribute to a new atmosphere. He announced some changes. There are administrative changes that went into effect this last Monday on the 12th. They don't affect Lynn so much because they're directed in large measure to the facility, at the individual institution or facility level. And the warden at Carswell, where Lynn is incarcerated, had approved her request the last time around. So it helps. It helps in a theoretical context. It's not really, for Lynn's case, a change in the rule.
Well, would it have been possible for Judge Codall, when you argued, for him to say, I'm ordering her release, or something short of that? What was it like when you went up there and argued and heard what
he said? Judge Codall wears a black robe, and we gave him the tools with which to do that.
What tools?
Well, among other things, it was an application not only under the compassionate release statute, where he really couldn't have done anything, but also under the law governing the writ of habeas corpus. And using the writ of habeas corpus, he had the power to release her, the power to reduce her sentence to time served and release her.
We were in court the day that he upped her sentence from 28 months to 10 years. And I remember you asking him why he did that. And he said, in essence, that he did it because his bosses in the appellate court told him to. So he really has her health on his hands, doesn't he?
Yes, and I think he knows that. I think he is troubled. One of the things his opinion makes clear is that if the Bureau of Prisons under the statute makes a motion, he will swiftly and compassionately view the motion. That's as much as signaling that he will grant it. Our application would have required him to think outside the box, and I think he is reluctant to do that, at least now.
What can we, our listeners, do to help things along?
You can continue your letter-writing campaign to the director of the Bureau of Prisons in Washington. You can contact your Congress people, both on the Senate side and on the House side, and urge them to get involved and to make known to the director that this is something that is important to them and that they are watching. Those are probably the things that count the most.
And we'll link on lawanddisorder.org to those addresses for people. Have you been down to see Lynn recently, or do you know people who have?
I know people who have. I have not been down to see her for a variety of reasons, though I talk to her on the phone fairly regularly. Cancer is a terrible disease.
Particularly when you're trying to cope with it in prison.
Particularly when you are trying to cope with it in prison.
Jill, is the reluctance on the Bureau of Prisons part purely political to send another message of this anti-terrorism climate, to be fearful of speaking out in ways that Lynn did?
I don't know the answer to that. I can say this, that if the Bureau of Prisons denies her second request, she's asked for reconsideration in light of the of her new prognosis from the Bureau of Prisons' own doctors. When they turned her down the first time in June, they said she wasn't sick enough. If they turn her down now, when she clearly, when their doctors say she is sick, she's sick enough, then that becomes a very good question, and I hope that Judge Codal will order discovery so that we can find out the answer.
We'll keep our fingers crossed and send our warmest wishes and many letters on behalf of Lynn. Thank you, Jill, so much.
Thanks for your good work, Jill.
Thank you for all of your help on her behalf.
In the wake of leaks about the National Security Agency's massive surveillance program, many ask what legal steps are being taken to stem the pervasive breach of civil liberties. We'll talk with attorney Carl Massinio from the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund about their campaign, One Nation Under Surveillance. Years before 9/11, the partnership was engaged in litigation and advocacy about the ways in which the government and corporations spy on individuals. Carl Massinio, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you very much.
Many Americans are becoming aware, perhaps for the first time, of the extent of the surveillance state in the United States. The Partnership for Civil Justice Fund actually launched a campaign called One Nation Under Surveillance over a year ago. Tell us about that.
Well, our One Nation Under Surveillance campaign really is a composite of multiple programs that the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund has undertaken to challenge and to fight back against the surveillance state. The programs include public records demands, FOIA requests, lawsuits, litigation, as well as campaign and advocacy. And you're correct. We've been looking at the issue of anti-terror authorities and surveillance authorities being misused to target law-abiding people in the United States, and in particular those engaged in political activity, well before even 9/11 happened. And I think that's an important element to recognize, which is that these anti-terror and surveillance authorities, while they were pumped up dramatically after 9/11, were actually being utilized to disrupt, to monitor, to surveil peaceful political activists even before that catastrophic event occurred.
Now, Carl, most people aren't aware of that. To what extent were private corporations involved in this kind of monitoring?
The monitoring is done at the behest of private corporations, and that's revealed most clearly in the public records disclosures that we have secured as relate to the Occupy movement. The Occupy movement and the Occupy Wall Street movement, which targeted, of course, corporate authority and corporate power, those documents reveal that the corporations were working hand in glove with law enforcement to surveil, to anticipate, to counter, to disrupt the political messaging that this grassroots peaceful movement had. And this is a movement that came about because there, across the country, there is tremendous economic insecurity. People in the middle class are underwater. People are one paycheck away from not being able to meet their basic needs. And as a consequence of this grassroots movement, a democratic movement came into existence. And what was the government's response? Instead of saying, this is wonderful, this is what the First Amendment says should happen, it turned its law enforcement authorities against this movement. It infiltrated it. It did so working with the Wall Street corporations. In fact, in New York City, the Wall Street corporations sit in the command centers of law enforcement so that they have absolute free access to the same flow of information that the command centers have.
How does this tie in with the recent revelations on the National Security Agency and their monitoring both every keystroke on our computers and what we say on the telephones, and not just foreigners, but Americans as well? Have you adjusted your appreciation of the extent of the emerging police state when you heard what Manning and Snowden had to say?
Yes, I think that what Manning and Snowden have revealed to us is really a clarion call to action. What we now see is that secretly and covertly there has been a systematic interception of all of our communications. And it's important to take a look at what is being intercepted. The NSA is clear. It does not intercept all of the communications and transmissions that occur electronically over the Internet. But what it does intercept comprehensively, Gmail communications, telephone logs of all of our communications, they have the ability with the touch of a keystroke and an email to be able to pull up a history of everyone, of whatever that email is associated with in terms of past email communications, chat histories, browsing histories. Now, who is that targeting? I mean, who is that targeting? It is targeting the law-abiding citizens and persons in the United States, because think about it for a second. What competent or sophisticated terrorist is going to be relying on Gmail or Google in order to conspire or plan? The undernet is not being captured. The undernet, the virtual private networks, the things that are very sophisticated and difficult to capture, are not the focus of this operation. The focus of the NSA's dragnet domestic spying operations is to include everything that we all engage in. And I think that it completely eliminates the concept of privacy. I mean, if they could go in and go into our personal therapists or counselors or priests or rabbis, space and hear what we communicated in our most personal moments, we would be outraged. But that is what they are gathering, accumulating, warehousing, and putting into a record-keeping system so that at the touch of a button, they can pull it up on anyone. Now, the privacy implications are staggering. The implications on democracy also are quite shocking, because this has all been done secretly. It's been done with secret courts in the United States. The senators who had knowledge and information and who were critical of this program did not even possess a First Amendment right to stand on the floor of the U.S. Senate and condemn or criticize or bring focus and attention to these details by citing specifics, because they were under gag orders. And each of the presidents, the past presidents, have approved and expanded this excessive executive authority.
Carl, speaking of that, talk for a moment about the notion of perpetual war and how the defense industry and private contractors rely on government contracts. Do you think they manufacture threat assessments in order to guarantee continued funding?
Well, we certainly know that the surveillance industrial complex is massive. In fact, Edward Snowden did not access the top secret documents that he did by working within the NSA. He had to work as a private contractor for Booz Allen, because Booz Allen Hamilton has got access to these tools of surveillance. And as he said, as a private contractor, he had the ability with an email to be able to wiretap anyone, including the presidents, he says, email communications and other communications. That has been privatized, and there's a huge profit incentive. There's a huge complex here. And the concept of permanent war. You know, the U.S. Constitution is very clear. There must be a declaration of war in order for the emergency powers that are ancillary to that to that declaration to come into possible effect. That is a critical element of democracy. There needs to be public debate before there is war. There needs to be a specific war before there is war, before expansive wartime authorities are used. But a new concept was developed under the Bush administration and is perpetuated under the current Obama administration, this notion that there is a permanent state of undeclared war, and therefore all authorities, regardless of the fact that they violate the Constitution, are available to the government. Now, this is completely anti-constitutional. It is against everything that frames the proper operation of government.
We're speaking with attorney Carl Massinio. We're getting his overview because his organization has been involved in both advocacy and litigation on behalf of the Movements for Social Change. We're getting his overview of what the surveillance state has accomplished, particularly with the Snowden and Manning revelations. Carl, can you speak further on what you think this government capacity has in terms of suppressing Movements for Social Change?
Well, that's an area where the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund's work has particularly been focused. As I was saying, before 9/11, we were securing in litigation and releasing to the public documents that established that anti-terror authorities, such as the Joint Terrorism Task Force, authorities that are very broad and very powerful, were being used not against, or not predominantly against terrorist suspects, but were being used routinely against, at that time period, prior to 2001, against the anti-globalization movement. After that, we've secured, both through litigation and public records demands, proof and evidence that those authorities continued then to be used against the anti-war movement, and then against the Occupy movement, so that what was the FBI reporting on and focused on in the days before the Boston Marathon bombing? Well, the demonstration activity that was going on in Boston under anti-terrorism authorities. And this is a historical reality of these powers. Anti-terror or anti-crime authorities have been used by the federal government as tools of social and political control and disruption. It's not just recent. This is exactly what J. Edgar Hoover did. This is what the COINTELPRO operations were when they tried to disrupt and subvert progressive social justice movements, the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement. All of those authorities were created ostensibly to prevent crime. But as a church committee reported in the aftermath of all of that, they were actually used for purposes outside of their justifications. They were used to target and to disrupt law-abiding democratic action in the United States. And this is the real threat. This is a predominant threat of having these tools of social and political control out there and systematically deployed so that the government and the corporations with whom they work hand in hand can anticipate, can know, and can suppress and disrupt democratic action, the lifeblood of a democracy, street movements, protest movements that are designed and intended to bring about a better culture, a better society, a better economic order.
Carl, what do you say about the fact that so many people in this country are reliant on personal electronic devices, thereby unwittingly perhaps allowing a direct portal from the government and corporations into their personal data? I know that even children from a very early age are targeted by retail marketers, Disney, McDonald's, getting them to be better consumers and to rely on really handing over personal data in exchange for befriend a fantasy creature and such. How would you advise people who say, well, we've gotten accustomed to this to conduct our communications, what can we do to roll back this tide of invasion of privacy?
We're not Luddites. Technology helps us. Technology is an advancement. Technology facilitates our transactions. It improves our lives. It enhances our communications. there is nothing negative about the fact that our transactions have been digitized. But they have been digitized. And along with technology comes an obligation of us to ensure that these tools of technology do not become distorted as tools of political and social and surveillance and population control. The reality is that we control how technology should be used. We can impose demands on the government. The government governs only by consent, and that's part of the violation here of all of this secrecy, the secret courts, the secret congressional briefings where even the senators are barred from discussing the information that they have. What can we do? Well, Ed Snowden, the other disclosures have all opened up a window of opportunity. And a new debate is occurring now across the country. It's a debate about how do we seize control over these technologies, because they don't need to be used against us. They can be used to facilitate what we transact. So at this point, we have a great window, and activism is necessary. What we're doing at the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund is a combination of activism and litigation. People need information. You can see the power of disclosure when people learn what the government is doing, and the government is operated in secret because it fears the public's reaction.
Carl, tell us about your most recent FOIA request related to the NSA spying.
We have posed a number of recent FOIA requests pertaining to the NSA spying, and right now we are engaged in an appeals process, which is the prerequisite to filing a lawsuit against the National Security Agency for seeking disclosure of their mass surveillance systems. We have filed public records demands with the NSA, with the FBI, with the CIA, with other defense and military entities, because that's who is doing this. This is coming out of the military. This is the militarization of our information. And our requests demand disclosure to the public. What are the record-keeping systems? What are the safeguards? What are the rules? What are the authorities? Because the people have the right to know. The people have the right to know and to engage in a full public debate about whether we want this implemented.
Carl, it's always wonderful to catch up with you, and we look forward to continuing this discussion as you get your information back on these FOIA requests and as your One Nation Under Surveillance campaign continues to gain traction.
Carl, you and Mara and the other folks at the Partnership for Civil Justice do a great job, and we congratulate you, and we thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
And thank you, and we think your program is a wonderful contribution to the dialogue and very helpful for people to hear, and it's always a pleasure to speak with you all.
Thanks, Carl. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
During the American War against Vietnamese independence 52 years ago, the American Air Force dropped millions of pounds of the toxic chemical defoliant Agent Orange. The chemical was used to kill vegetation in order to deny the Vietnamese liberation fighters both ground cover and food. The long-term devastation wrought by Agent Orange upon millions of Vietnamese and many thousands of U.S. soldiers has yet to be properly accounted for and compensated for. Giant chemical companies such as Monsanto and Dow profited from the defoliant chemical and has paid very little to settle the veterans' lawsuits for the Agent Orange-related diseases. Meanwhile, second and third generation Vietnamese civilians have been seriously affected by Agent Orange exposure. We're joined today by National Lawyers Guild attorney Marjorie Cohn, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and on the board of the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign. Her latest article, The Struggle Continues, Seeking Compensation for Vietnamese Agent Orange Victims 52 Years On, details a strategy for compensating victims of the Agent Orange chemical.
Welcome, Marjorie Cohn, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. My pleasure to be here.
It's hard to believe that last week marked the 52nd anniversary of the beginning of the U.S. chemical warfare program of Agent Orange in Vietnam. Can you give us a brief nutshell of the devastation that Agent Orange has wrought on not only the Vietnamese, but U.S. soldiers?
Well, studies show that between 2,100,000 and 4,800,000 Vietnamese and tens of thousands of Americans were exposed to Agent Orange during the spraying of Vietnam from 1961 to 1971. And many other Vietnamese were or continue to be exposed to Agent Orange through contact with the environment and food that was contaminated or as offspring of those exposed who now suffer from illnesses and disabilities. And the Department of Veterans Affairs recognized certain illnesses and diseases as being associated with the spraying and use of Agent Orange by the U.S. Armed Forces during the Vietnam era. And they include amyloidosis, chronic B-cell leukemia, chlorine, diabetes, Hodgkin's disease, ischemic heart disease, multiple myeloma, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, Parkinson's, neuropathy, prostate cancer, respiratory cancers, and soft tissue sarcomas. And we're talking about unknown numbers of people in the millions who were exposed to these and continue to suffer. The progeny, the children and grandchildren of people exposed to Agent Orange during the Vietnam War, continue to be born with horrific birth defects, some babies without brain cavities, without limbs. It's absolutely horrific.
The U.S. government has not really taken responsibility in admitting this, has it?
No, it has not. And in fact, during the Nixon administration, there was a promise in 1973 as part of the peace accords that were signed in Paris. The Nixon administration promised to contribute $3 billion toward reconstruction and healing the wounds of war, and that money has not been forthcoming. Now, there has been some compensation, not nearly enough. The U.S. veterans have some limited compensation for their health effects from Agent Orange, not nearly enough. The chemical companies, specifically Dow and Monsanto, paid a pittance to settle the veterans' lawsuit to compensate them as unintended victims for their Agent Orange-related illnesses. But the intended victims of Agent Orange, the Vietnamese victims, sued the chemical companies in U.S. federal court and were unsuccessful. But nevertheless, the lawsuit spawned a movement to hold the United States accountable for using these dangerous chemicals.
And one of the most important things to come out of that movement, and I work with the Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign, and our organization has been working with members of Congress in drafting legislation to try to provide compensation to Vietnamese victims, Vietnamese Americans, and U.S. soldiers for their Agent Orange-related illnesses. It's called H.R. 2519, the Victims of Agent Orange Relief Act of 2013. Once again, that's H.R. 2519. And it would provide medical, rehabilitative, and social service compensation to Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange and medical services for children of U.S. Vietnam veterans and Vietnamese Americans who have been born with these same diseases and birth defects. It would also remediate or clean up hot spots which have been contaminated by dioxin. And I should say that dioxin is the culprit in this in Agent Orange, dioxin, the most toxic chemical known to science. And there are still places in Vietnam called hot spots which continue to be contaminated by dioxin. People around those hot spots get ill. It contaminates the food, the water.
Now, are you saying the agent or the dioxin has remained in the soil there? In
yes.
those hot spots?
Yes, it is still in the soil, believe it or not. And many of these hot spots are located in areas near U.S. Army bases. The reason that the U.S. military sprayed Agent Orange and other toxic chemicals was to defoliate the areas around the U.S. Army bases to protect them against the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese. And dating back to 2007, the United States has engaged in some environmental remediation of these hotspots at the Da Nang and Benoit airports and provided funds for public health and disabilities activities for individuals residing in some affected areas. But there are still many, many hotspots all over Vietnam. And one of the most important things that this legislation would do is to give assistance to the Vietnamese to remediate those geographic areas that still have high levels of Agent Orange. And it would particularly prioritize areas that served as military bases where Agent Orange was handled and areas where heavy spraying and air crashes resulted in harmful deposits of Agent Orange.
We're speaking with attorney Marjorie Cohn, a former president of the National Lawyers Guild, who's active in trying to help victims of Agent Orange. Marjorie, the Agent Orange wasn't dropped on Vietnam until 1961, but American forces began fighting against the Vietnamese much earlier than that. Did people that dropped dioxin on civilians and actually contaminated their own soldiers, did they know the harmful effects of this stuff when they dropped it?
I don't think they did. Now, the U.S. government and the chemical companies did know about it, and they covered up a report. They actually kept it under wraps, and it wasn't until that report became public in 1969, I believe. I could be wrong, but it was in the late 60s, that they stopped spraying Agent Orange because of the negative publicity. But the U.S. government knew, because of these studies, what was happening, and the chemical companies knew what was in the spray.
So they dropped it without knowing what the effects would be, and then when they started learning about what it had done, they covered that up.
That's right, yes.
It seems to me it would be a really good public relations effort if the chemical companies were to go in now and to remediate.
Yes, that's true. And there again, but you know, one of the problems is that when the U.S. veterans brought their lawsuit and it was settled for a pittance, the judge in New York, the federal court judge, told the chemical companies, "Your responsibility is over now." I think his name was Weinstein, Judge Weinstein. And so then when the Vietnamese victims, the intended victims of the spraying, came into court, they were thrown, he threw them out of court. So I don't think that there is going to be any more liability by the chemical companies, and that's the reason. And they were the ones who were initially sued in both of these lawsuits. So now it falls to the U.S. government to make good on its promise during the Nixon signing of the peace accords in Paris in 1973 and of course more than that money, because there's the effects were just unknown how horrific they would be at the time, to provide compensation for the Vietnamese, for Vietnamese Americans and their progeny who suffer from the effects of Agent Orange, and to give U.S. veterans of Vietnam additional compensation because they don't receive anywhere near the compensation that they should for their injuries, their health effects as unintended victims of the spraying of Agent Orange.
Do you have a website so that listeners could go to it to find out how to help in this and to learn more about it?
Yes. If you type in Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign, you could also just type in the initials, capital letters, V-A-O-R-R-C. V-A-O-R-R-C, Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign. And I would urge everyone listening to this broadcast to make sure that your congressperson is a co-sponsor of H.R. 2519, the Victims of Agent Orange Relief Act of 2013. Congresswoman Barbara Lee from California introduced the legislation. There are now 12 co-sponsors. Brian Higgins, a Democrat from New York's 26th District, is a co-sponsor. I don't believe that any other New York congresspeople are co-sponsors of the legislation. The most important thing people can do is to take that bill number and write or email or call your congressperson and urge your congressperson to support, to sign on to this legislation, and you can get more information about the legislation at our website, the VAORC website, V-A-O-R-R-C, Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign.
Marjorie, we just have a few minutes left, but I want to go back for a moment to the lawsuit. Were you and others involved in this campaign surprised at the decision?
I was not directly involved in the lawsuit. Jean Meyer from the International Association of Democratic Lawyers and the National Lawyers Guild, as well as Jonathan Moore, were the lead lawyers in the lawsuits. I think they were extremely disappointed, especially with the settlement in the first one, which was not. I don't know that they represented those the Vietnam veterans. I think that they represented the Vietnamese later. But when they came in later, their clients were thrown out of court. And one of the strongest reasons was that the judge had assured the chemical companies they wouldn't have any more liability. So that was a severe disappointment. But those lawyers and people who were involved in the lawsuit by the Vietnamese to receive some compensation did go on to participate and build this very strong movement now to achieve compensation, and working through VAORC and working through organizations in Vietnam have sponsored this legislation, which is really, really important to remedy one of the most shameful legacies of the Vietnam War. And Obama, who was 14 at the time of the Vietnam War, has come out with a campaign to what looks like rewrite the history of the Vietnam War in a way that it actually lies about what the U.S. did in Vietnam and the result of that war. So I think that people need to be wary when they see a campaign coming out of the White House to rewrite the history of the Vietnam War, that a lot of that is false.
I can tell you in a nutshell the history, because I was active in the anti-war movement. The Vietnamese were fighting for their own independence, first against the Japanese, who had invaded after the Second World War, then against the French, who had reinvaded and ran it as a colony. And when they beat the French in 1954 at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, the United States stepped into the French boots and wanted to make sure that the Vietnamese weren't going to gain any kind of meaningful self-determination. And that's when they started introducing troops. It was a big campaign, and finally Kennedy got on board for it. In his last year, Kennedy rethought it, but the order that he had signed trying to get American troops out of there, when Kennedy was assassinated, American troops stayed there. Johnson sent more troops. Nixon sent more troops. The United States, in my opinion, They lost the battle for Vietnam, but in a sense they won the war because they so devastated that country, particularly with Agent Orange, that it's been very, very hard for the Vietnamese to get back on their feet. So what's the lesson here? You step out of line and try to run your own country, we'll destroy you.
That's correct. You're right. And, of course, getting into sending troops in the first place was based on a lie during the Johnson administration, the Tonkin Gulf incident, which was completely false, that the U.S. ship had been attacked by a North Vietnamese boat in the Gulf of Tonkin. They knew it was false, and yet Congress was hoodwinked. There were probably some people in Congress who knew the truth, but Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and then U.S. troops were introduced. The U.S. had had military advisors in Vietnam for many years before that, but that is one of the great lies. Another one being the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq as an excuse, a false excuse to facilitate the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 during the Bush administration.
What kind of support are we getting for this effort to do something to help people victimized by Agent Orange?
Well, there has been a lot of support for this bill. I think the bill is key. Certainly, there are other ways to get involved as well, and I urge people to go on the VAROC website. But, for example, the op-ed that Jean Myrer and I wrote, which appeared on many of the blogs, including Huffington Post, Common Dreams, Counterpunch, etc., has received a lot of very positive feedback, and people have been contacting us at VAROC to see how they can get involved and help. A lot of people don't know about this, and especially some of the younger people who were not around during Vietnam, who have no idea about this shameful legacy that the U.S. has left. If people have an opportunity to visit Vietnam and meet some of these victims and their caregivers, it's absolutely heartrending. And I have actually met many of them. It's hidden away from us. We don't see it. We don't hear about it. And yet we spend billions and billions of dollars on the military and on bigger and better weapons and are not taking care of business and fulfilling our obligation to compensate and remediate people for the horrific effects of the spraying of Agent Orange on their country during the Vietnam War.
Marjorie, we'd like to thank you and Jeannie Meyer for your wonderful article on this and your hard work to seek justice. And we look forward to following up with you about H.R. 2519.
And we'll link to your article on lawanddisorder.org.
Thank you so much, Heidi and Michael. I appreciate it.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.